Welcome to Nevermore Podcast, a production by the Three Little Sisters. The Three Little Sisters is an independent publishing house focused on unique and strange voices from across the globe. Today's episode is brought to you by Mobile Sounds, where you can get all your DJ needs met. To find out how to book your event, contact Mobile Sounds on Facebook at Mobile Sounds. Today's podcast, we're going to be focusing on several fairy tales for Fairy Tale Month. We're going to be talking about Cinderella and the Glass Slipper, Rapunzel and Princesses and Towers, Sleeping Beauty and Poison Apples, and also things from the sea like the Little Mermaid. Join us as we dive in and discuss all this and more on today's podcast. Today we're joined by our executive coordinator, Xiao Milin Barubi. Welcome to the program, Xiao.
Hi there. Nice to be here again.
Sheila is always busy doing tons of work around here. All of our layout usually goes through her. Some of our covers go through her. She's a very, very busy, busy lady. And if you ever need anything as an author, or if you're interested in getting one of our books for review, she is the girl to contact. And today's program, we're going to be discussing first the fairy tale of Cinderella. So in this discussion, I think Xiel has prepared for us reading a section of Cinderella from the Brothers Grimm.
Yes, I do have. I have the original version from the Brothers Grimm Fairy Tales. It is aptly named the same thing, Cinderella. I'm just going to read an excerpt. Everybody knows about the glass slipper. Everybody knows how the prince comes and says, okay, whoever's foot fits this, you're mine. You're my wife. Well, Brothers Grimm had a little bit more of a darker way of putting that slipper out there for other people to read. And it goes a little like this. The prince took the shoe and went the next day to the king, his father, and said, I will take for my wife the lady that this golden slipper fits. Then both the sisters, that's the evil stepsisters, by the way, were overjoyed to hear it, for they had beautiful feet, and had no doubt that they could wear the golden slipper. The eldest went first into the room where the slipper was, and wanted to try it on, and the mother stood by, but her great toe could not go into it, and the shoe was altogether much too small for her. Then the mother gave her a knife and said, Never mind, cut it off. When you are a queen, you will not care about toes. You will not want to walk. So the silly girl cut her off her great toe and thus squeezed on the shoe and went to the king's son. Then he took her for his bride and set her beside him on his horse and rode away with her homewards. But on their way home, they had to pass by the hazel tree that Cinderella had planted. And on the branch sat a little dove singing, back again, look to the shoe. The shoe is too small and not made for you. Prince, prince, look again for thy bride, for she's not the true one that sits by thy side. Then the prince got down and looked at her foot and saw, by the blood that streamed from it, what a trick she had played him. So he turned his horse round and brought the false bride back to her home and said, This is not the right bride. Let the other sister try and put on the slipper. Then she went into the room and got her foot into the shoe, all but the heel, which was too large. But her mother squeezed it in till the blood came and took her to the king's son. And she set her as his bride by his side on his horse and rode away with her. But when they came to the hazel tree, the little dove sat there still and sang, back again, look to the shoe. The shoe is too small and not made for you. Prince, prince, look again for thy bride, for she's not the true one that sits by thy side. Then he looked down and saw that the blood streamed so much from the shoe that her white stockings were quite red. So he turned his horse and brought her also back again. This is not the true bride, said he to the father. Have you no other daughters? No, said he, there is only a little dirty Cinderella here, the child of my first wife. I am sure she cannot be the bride. Prince told him to send her. But the mother said, No, no, she is much too dirty. She will not dare to show herself. However, the prince would have her come, and she first washed her face and hands, and then went in and curtsied to him. And he reached her the golden slipper. Then she took her clumsy shoe off her left foot and put on the golden slipper. And it fitted her as if it had been made for her. And when he drew near and looked at her face, he knew her and said, "This is the right bride." So as you can tell, it's quite grim, quite literally like their last name, Grimm. It's not nothing like what you see in Disney.
Very true. It's nothing like that you see in Disney. In fact, according to a huge website that dedicates itself to fairy tales called Sur la Lune, there is a documented almost 1,000 variants of Cinderella. So Disney is not the only one to show a different take on her. In fact, according to their website, in 1892, Marion Roloff Cox compiled a book called Cinderella, 345 Variants of Cinderella, Catskins and Cap o' Rushes, Abstracted and Tabulated. This whole book actually contains excerpts from various tales around the world that are very similar to the story of Cinderella. In fact, in one abstract here called Folk Tales of Iceland, collected in 1862, there's an interesting excerpt in here that shows a very similar take that the Brothers Grimm actually might have actually taken their story from. And it says here that Prince asks to see daughter with shoe on, then offers to marry her and takes her to his ship. When thy slave sailed a short distance, two birds settled in the rigging and said, "At the prow sits hue and heel, full is her shoe with blood. At the home sits Majaveg in her golden tower. Turn back, king's son." So here we see the same thing, the mutilated foot, and this is a very similar thread across all of the Cinderella narratives. This is probably likely due to the fact that a lot of peasants thought that princesses actually did remove chunks of their feet, and that's why they had such small feet. Foot mutilation, foot binding, was very popular in early parts of the eras, depending on which country you lived in. So this could be hearkening back to how princesses traveled. If you looked at medieval England or earlier than that, most princesses did not walk on foot. And so this is where we get the idea that princesses could be almost lazy, relaxed, and have no need for even their feet. And that's a very interesting take on what their view of princesses were.
It is an interesting take, and it's actually cross-cultural too. Like you said, look at the Chinese and their lotus foot way back in Ming Dynasty, even before that and after that. Lotus foot was foot binding, and it's along the same lines as foot mutilation, exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, and I found that this abstract book, although it's a little bit, I would say that this book is probably not recommended for children, but if you are really interested in analyzing folktales and where they come from, Sur la Lune has a documented history of every single fairy tale that has ever existed, and they show abstracts that have been written for hundreds of years that analyze each of these tales and show their variants. It's a really fascinating website. Highly recommended, and it will be shown in the links underneath our YouTube podcast. If you're looking to get into more research on variations of tales, so don't always assume that what you're reading or what you're watching about Cinderella is a accurate take on what the story is really about. What do you think, Sheila, the story of Cinderella is really trying to tell us?
I'm pretty sure, for me anyway, my take on it is the class or caste difference between the rich and the poor, for one. That's one part of the story. I mean, look at the way the rich behave in the story, right? They've got everything. The rich father who marries another evil stepmother, right? And she acts like that stereotypical rich person who, "I've got everything and you're nothing because you're poor, because you're here because I let you be here," kind of deal. That stereotypical rich version of rich people. Not so much the prince, obviously, but It's also, I find, a stereotypical view of fashion, even. Look at Victorian times. Heavyset women were more desirable. Nowadays, what is it? Thin, almost skin and bones is the new normal. And it keeps bouncing back and forth. And I think Cinderella is very much a story about that, too, is caste. Your place in life according to money, fashion, whatever it is, right? What you look like, who you are, and it's a moral story about that.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about Cinderella is that the variations of her story change from culture to culture. So each of the stories feature some different aspect, and not all of them have her being mutilated or having the stepsisters being mutilated. What it has is that Cinderella is the one who gets vindicated, who is the one who gets liberated. But in her liberation, there's also this sense of that. She's not really escaping anything. She's just changing one set of chains for another. She's leaving behind a life of servitude for a life in the palace, but who knows if that life is something that is good. And so that is one thing that's never really answered in Cinderella is her life happy once she gets to this palace and seems to have everything she ever wants and needs? Is this really a good place to exist? Because being in the court would have been extremely difficult, especially if you had no real bearing or coming with sort of a background of power. If your family was nothing and she came from nothing, she wouldn't have an easy time integrating herself in the court. So it, I think it's interesting, depending on what variation of the story that you read, that she changes and reflects what was very normal in that culture. So it's really fascinating when you look at her story and going across the board and really understanding what these fairy tales are trying to say. To me, one of the aspects that I would like to discuss is the aspect of the fairy godmother. So in variations, depending on which story that you read, there was not always a fairy godmother. So in one of the stories that comes from Russia called The Wonderful Birch, the birch tree itself was actually the one that had power to it. And it's very kind of interesting when you look at it that way. It changes the fairy godmother into more of a witch. So it says in the Russian version, for example, that there was a festival, and that's when Cinderella met this witch. And the witch said to the man, "Go you on to the front, old man, with our youngest. I will give you the elder girl work to keep her from being dull in our absence." And so the man took the child and set out, but the witch kindled a fire on the hearth and threw a pot full of barleycorns among the cinders and said to the girl, "If you have not picked out the barley out of the ashes and put it all back in the pot the night before, I shall eat you up." So in this case, the stepmother is actually a witch, which I thought was kind of interesting. And that changes depending on what story that you read. Sometimes the witch is actually the fairy godmother. Sometimes it's actually a birch tree itself that is giving Cinderella her gifts. I believe in Grimm's Brothers that she actually planted a birch tree outside of her home.
A
And then
hazel
as
tree,
she's
actually, in Brothers
a hazel
Grimm.
tree, sorry, a
Yeah.
hazel tree. So there's a very fascinating connection between trees and Cinderella. There's a really fascinating book where these two women, they're a mother and daughter team, and they were discussing fairy tales. And they said that there's a lot of connection between trees, and that is very likely due to the fact that in Scandinavian cultures and German cultures, trees have a lot to do with healing and also with women. So hazels and ashes and birches symbolize something that is new or young.
That doesn't
And
surprise me either, because take the aspen, for example. Aspen is, if you take the bark of aspen and put it in your mouth, it reacts like an analgesic. It's like aspirin. That's where we get aspirin from. So it doesn't surprise me that it's associated with healing and women. Women were the healers, and it's associated with the trees and plants and natural environment.
Yeah, so I find that that's very fascinating that she really, depending on what variation that you read, this concept of witch was very strong. Either the witch is the stepmother, or the witch is the fairy godmother, or somehow Cinderella is part witch in that she can just make these magical objects appear out of this tree. So there is a definitely a magical concept that was in there. And I believe when it was Disneyfied and turned into more the Bibbidi-Bobbidi Boo type fairy godmother, that this was sort of like culminating all the ideas of having a magical element still exist and keeping sort of somewhat of that tradition alive when you looked at Cinderella.
Considering that witches right across the board for all of the cultures, I'm not surprised either that Disney actually chose the fairy godmother piece to solidify and indemnify the whole cross-culture idea of Cinderella.
Exactly. So that's pretty much a wrap on talking about Cinderella and the Glass Slipper. We encourage you to keep researching these fairy tales, and you can find all of the information about Cinderella that we used in this podcast will be linked below when we post on YouTube.
I would just like to let you all know the version of the Brothers Grimm fairy tales that I have in front of me is an illustrated classic version. The illustrations are by author Rackham, and it's the Canterbury Classics imprint from Printers Row Publishing Group. So that's where that credit comes from that little excerpt that I read to you folks.
And all of that again will be provided at the bottom of our YouTube page. When the podcast posts, you will get all the ISBN numbers and references that you need to conduct your own investigation on fairy tales. This episode of Nevermore Podcast has been brought to you by the Three Little Sisters Publishing. This month, we celebrated the Happy Barn Cat. Have you ever wanted to know how to rescue and care for orphan cats? The Happy Barn Cat is your ultimate guide to helping you lead your best life with your favorite pet. Catch this amazing title that's currently available on our website at www.thethree, that's the number three, littlesisters.com. Welcome to Nevermore Podcast, a production by the Three Little Sisters. The Three Little Sisters is an independent publishing house focusing on unique and odd voices from around the globe. Today on the program, I'm joined by Executive Coordinator Xiao Mulin Berube, and we are discussing fairy tales. In our first episode, we were reviewing Cinderella and the Glass Slipper, using the Grimm Brothers and Disney as a comparison, as well as using the website Sur La Lune to really dive into the variants of this fairy tale. On this episode, we're going to be reviewing Rapunzel and Girls in the Tower. This is a fascinating theme for me, as Rapunzel is probably one of my most favorite tales, because I find that not a lot of people know where her name truly comes from. So I'm going to read an excerpt today from Rapunzel by Jacob Grimm. This was a part of their original version. And in this version, I'm going to share with you an excerpt on where Rapunzel's name comes from. Once upon a time, there was a man and a woman who had long, but to no avail, wished for a child. Finally, the woman came to believe that the good Lord would fulfill her wish. Through her rear view window of these people's houses, they could see a splendid garden that was filled with the most beautiful flowers and herbs. The garden was surrounded by a high wall, and no one dared enter because it belonged to a sorceress who had possessed great power and was feared by everyone. One day the woman was standing by the window, and she saw a bed planted with the most beautiful Rapunzel. It looked so fresh and green, and she longed for some. It was her greatest desire to eat some of the Rapunzel. This desire increased with every day, and not knowing how to get any, she became miserably ill. Her husband was frightened and asked her, "What ails you, dear wife?" "Oh," she answered, "if I do not get some Rapunzel from the garden behind our house, I shall die." The man who loved her dearly thought, "Before you let your wife die, you must get her some Rapunzel, whatever the cost." So just as it was getting dark, He climbed over the high wall into the sorceress's garden, hastily dug up a handful of Rapunzel, and took it to his wife. She immediately made a salad from it, which she devoured eagerly. It tasted so very good to her that the next day she desired for it so much that her desire grew threefold. If she were to have any peace, the man would have to climb into the garden once again. Thus he just set forth, just as it was getting dark. But no sooner had he climbed over the wall than, to his horror, before him stood the sorceress. "How dare you," she asked with an angry look, "to climb into my garden like a thief to steal my Rapunzel? You will pay for this." "Oh," he answered, "let mercy overrule justice. I came to do this out of necessity. My wife saw your Rapunzel from her window, and such a longing came over her that she would die if she did not get some to eat." The sorceress's anger abated somewhat, and she said, "If things are as you say, I will let you take as much Rapunzel as you want, but under one condition. You must give me the child that your wife will bring to this world. I will do well, and I will take care of it like a mother." In this fear, the man agreed to everything. And that is where Rapunzel's name comes from the actual lettuce that was named rapini, which is an Italian type of parsley. So that is a very interesting connection between Rapunzel and food.
It is an interesting connection. And it's funny that you should mention last episode about the variances. You're reading out of Brothers Grimm, but my Brothers Grimm actually calls it rampion, which is Campanula rampunculus, which is from a species of parsnip. So it's rather interesting that both of us are holding our Brothers Grimm story of Rapunzel, but we have two different food substances in our two different stories.
Yeah, it's really fascinating that there's some connection between her and gardens and plants, because there's nothing else in the Rapunzel tale about food. That's the only piece. The rest of it is about her hair. So I'm not really quite sure why they made that leap between this very deep connection between herbs and herbal remedies, but there is a slight chance that this was indicating that Rapunzel herself had some special healing type quality, and that was definitely exploited in the Disney version when Rapunzel's hair was used to make Mother Gollum or young again. And so there's something definitely mystical and magical again connected between women, the earth, and herbs that you could eat that would somehow imbue their properties onto a child.
It's also interesting that you should bring that up, that women and earth and, you know, healing, women are also associated with, of all things, fertility. Her golden hair is the sun. That's a sign of fertility. The fact that women can heal is a sign of womanly virility, in a way. We're the ones who bear life. We're the ones who take care of that life. We're the ones that wipe away the tears when our child cries or hurts or skins their knee. Who's the one who kisses it? Mother's kiss heals any wound. It's a very deep connection to the womb, in a way.
And it's possible that some of these herbs might have some properties that are relatively unknown or possibly known to people. Parsnip, for example, has some very strong properties of healing. And consuming that food is very common in places like Italy. There's some other places that eat parsnip, but Italy is the one that really strongly comes to mind, because parsnips are a root vegetable and they're very easy to grow, very easy to access.
And they're also a root to Mother Earth. You're rooted in the earth. It's another association with being rooted to your natural environment. And women are rooted to producing life. Gardens are rooted to producing life.
Right. And now let's sort of flip and talk about some of the darker aspects of Rapunzel. Because when her life is now given over to this witch, she actually spends a majority of her time locked in this tower. Now, the idea of towers, really historically, have been always a place that has been predominantly dominated by the vision of a princess in the tower. And that is very likely because of the fact that women actually were placed in physical towers, often very far away from battles, very far away from people that could access them. And towers were a way to control women's movements and also access to these women. So towers are a very common motif when you look at how princesses are sort of viewed in certain societies.
Absolutely. You have it spot on there. Also, towers are meant to imprison as well. I mean, the English did it well back in Victorian times. The big number one tower was their big prison tower. It'd be damned if I can remember what the name of it was. I think it was The Tower, actually. It's featured in movies all the time, from everything from Robin Hood to Braveheart. That tower is featured. And yes, and Lady Marian in Robin Hood was in a tower, or a form of tower. And it was William Wallace that was in prison, not a woman, mind you, but look at the queen who came and visited him in that quote unquote tower. So it's actually crossing more than just our fairy tales here in Rapunzel. It crosses across even to men, to restrict certain men that they didn't like as well, not just women.
Exactly. And there really is an almost protective, stoic-like quality to a tower. And I think that when you really look at it, some of the darkest parts of medieval history could sort of be bound and wound around the vision of the tower. Like, for example, when you look at kings like King Henry, for example, even though he was way past Middle Ages, he used towers to imprison women to, that's where they stayed. Now, a lot of times, towers were a very safe and sanctuary type place. Women would go there to give birth or go there to be away from the men that were in their lives. So sometimes the tower was used for protection, but oftentimes it was used as punishment. We know that, for example, the Tower of England was used to house queens that King Henry did not like. There were several executed there. There was also towers used to imprison women. We know that the story, for example, of Elizabeth Bathory, she was imprisoned in a tower. And there's several other stories where towers were used more like a punishment than a safe space.
Yeah, you bring up a great one from well before Victorian times is Elizabeth Bathory. She was actually imprisoned in a tower and blockaded in alive. So she didn't die right away. They didn't, you know, she was there to die in that tower. That's a pretty, if you want to go that dark, that one's a good example of a tower for punishment. And then you've got like, look at the Great Wall of China. It has towers at every section. You could say that that's a protective version. And there's another aspect of towers too, the protectiveness of, you know, a woman's virginity. A father would lock her away. Chastity belts could be said to be, you know, a representation of that tower as well, in a smaller version, more mobile version. You know, is it to keep a woman woman's chastity and keep her chaste.
Exactly. And it's kind of fascinating that it sort of has this double meaning. The other dark aspect of Rapunzel that is that in some variants, once the prince tries to rescue Rapunzel, the witch actually flings him out of the tower and he lands on thorns. And the thorns actually scratch and poke at his eyes and he goes blind. In the Grimm's Brothers version, he says here, he escapes with his life, but the thorns into which he fell poked out his eyes. Blind, he wanders about the forest, eating nothing but grass and roots, and doing nothing but weeping and wailing over the loss of his beloved wife. Thus he wanders about miserably for some years. Finally, happening into the wilderness,
wanders into about the wilderness.
Sorry, I'm sorry, my phone just went off for some reason. He heard a voice and thought it was familiar. He advanced towards it and he approached. Rapunzel recognized him and, crying, threw her arms around her neck. Two of her tears fell into his eyes, and they became clear once again, and he could see as well as before. He led her into her kingdom, where he was received with joy. For a long time, they lived happily and satisfied. So this is kind of an interesting, again, weird darkness that it kind of pervades the idea of Grimm. But it's interesting that her tears are healing. And again, this is another instance when you see something about her that Disney definitely put into Rapunzel, because Flynn Rider almost dies and Rapunzel's tears are the thing that brings him back. So it's interesting that they make so many connections between women and healing and women and magic and women having the ability to almost bring back the dead or to restore blindness. Like, that's an amazing power that they sort of weave into women. I think oftentimes when we look at fairy tales, you almost see them as very misogynistic or talking down to women or making women seem like they're useless. But when you really read some of the older versions of the stories, the princesses are the ones that have the most power. They're magical. And these men who achieve these magical beings usually gain some sort of fortune out of that. So maybe this is almost a play on the new world and the old world sort of meeting, meddling, and marrying and creating like a new world where you have, you know, maybe a society that is no longer believing in magic, marrying the society that still does. And this hybrid creates a more perfect union, and to lack of a better word.
I concur. I agree completely. You're right. It's kind of like it's like the Brothers Grimm were on the cusp of, you know, a world that was changing too. So you have your old school, oh, you know, women are healers and this and that. And it reflects in their writing that the women are the stronger gender in these stories than what we're used to seeing, say, in even Disney, or except for Shrek, of course, because Fiona, we all know Fiona is just badarsed, cool princess who can kick butt. She's one of the few princesses that is like that, other than Mulan and, you know, a few others. But yes, their writing is a reversal of roles that we're used to today. Today's role of gender, men are to do this and women are this. But back then it was, you go to a woman healer to get well again. You didn't go to a male healer. There were none.
Right. And the concept that women are intrinsically magical is, I just think, a very valuable story. So to parents out there who are concerned about reading these fairy tales to your children because you're worried about the kind of overtones that they have, don't be. If you look to the Grimm's brothers' versions of the stories, and you definitely should invest in buying the new version that has just been released, because they have actually restored all the original Grimm's brothers in unedited form. So these are the true tales. And although we may think of them as grim or weird or having these uncomfortable elements like death and poisoning and blindness, that's not really the point of the story. And they are more tales of showing a connection to things that have always existed, where magic ruled and women had some power, and that you could change your fate or destiny easily. And I think these kind of themes and motifs are really important for children to have, and really does increase their ability to analyze text and analyze stories in a much different way. So I think that's about wraps it up on our discussion about Rapunzel, unless there's anything you want to add.
No, I think you did a great job in concluding that discussion, and I look forward to the next one.
All right, so all the links that we have referred to throughout this program will be provided at the bottom of our YouTube page, and you can do your own research to find out some of the wonderful variants of Rapunzel. We encourage you to keep on researching and finding out the truth of things, because that's what we're all about here at the Three Little Sisters. We don't just do books. We want you to read the books, enjoy the books, and really analyze what these books are trying to convey. With that in mind, we are honoring our freebie download page today. On our freebie page, you can actually access a number of free books completely available in ebook. They can be supported on any device that you have. The books are available for children and adults. We have currently three titles available for children, or will have three titles available. Currently, there's only two. The first one is Little Bird Books ABCs. Come join us through an adventure of learning your alphabet. And then we also have Sue's Flight this month. Sue's Flight is a story of an elephant who just dreams about wanting to fly. Both of these books can be downloaded to your tablet and read to your children or given to your children to read. They are there to help you support your child learning the basics of reading before they hit the kindergarten. For adults, we have The Bone Jar, which is still available for download, and again, supported on any device that you have. This episode of the Nevermore podcast has been mixed by Mobile Sounds. Contact Mobile Sounds for all your DJ needs. They have a Facebook page at Mobile Sounds. And that is the end of our episode on Rapunzel. Follow us next time when we are going to now discuss Sleeping Beauty. Welcome to the Nevermore podcast, a production by the Three Little Sisters. Right now we are discussing fairy tales, as it is fairy tale month. In our last episode, we were discussing the story of Rapunzel and women in the tower. On today's episode, we're going to be diving into Sleeping Beauty and the variants of her story. I'm joined on the podcast by Executive Coordinator Shiel Mulan-Berube. Welcome again to the program, Shiel.
Nice to be back. And why don't I start off with an actual excerpt from Brothers Grimm's Fairy Tales from Sleeping Beauty. We're going to go with the moment that she actually pricks her finger on the spindle. So, as it goes, by way of Brothers Grimm, it happened that, on the very day she was 15 years old, the king and queen were not at home, and she was left alone in the palace. So she roved about by herself and looked at all the rooms and chambers, till at last she came to an old tower, there's those towers again, up which there was a narrow staircase ending with a little door. In the door there was a golden key. And when she turned it, the door sprang open, and there sat an old lady spinning away very busily. "Why, how now, good mother," said the princess, "what are you doing there?" "Spinning," said the old lady, and nodded her head, humming a tune while buzz went the wheel. "How prettily that little thing turns round," said the princess, and took the spindle and began to try to spin. But scarcely had she touched it before the fairy's prophecy was fulfilled. The spindle wounded her, and she fell down lifeless on the ground. However, she was not dead, but had only fallen into a deep sleep, and the king and the queen had just come home, and all their court fell asleep too, and the horses slept in the stables, and the dogs in the court, the pigeons on the housetop, and the very flies slept upon the walls. Even the fire on the hearth left off blazing, and went to sleep. And Jack stopped, and the spit that was turning about with a goose upon it, for the king's dinner stood still, and the cook, who was at that moment, pulling the kitchen boy by the hair to give him a box on the ear for something he had done amiss, let him go, and both fell asleep. The butler, who was slyly tasting the ale, fell asleep with the jug at his lips, and thus everything stood still and slept soundly.
This is again one of the fairy tales that I really, really enjoy, mostly because of the villain Maleficent. How can you not like her? I mean, she is amazing. Any villain that's called the mistress of all evil is pretty awesome. But in most of the variations of Sleeping Beauty, she's not actually evil at all. And that's one of the fascinating ironies of the story. Sometimes there's not even a an evil villain actually mentioned. And so if you really dive into this story and really see what it's about, is it really about the spindle? What is this connection between spindle, spinning, weaving, and the mistress of all evil? Maybe that there's something there that we're not seeing.
For me, the connection between spindle and weaving and creating is, again, about life, giving life. You know, you give life to your creations. Women give life to their children. Without them, without their womb, nothing is birthed, nothing is born, nothing is created. And for Malfeasant, she really isn't a villain. She's a very hurt, very heartbroken, left out, castaway person. And that's what is represented in her, quote, curse.
And there are some very dark elements of her story that you can really see in the fact that she's put to sleep. And in fact, in one variation, I believe, and I don't remember what variation it was, the prince that rescues her in the end actually ends up at the castle when the vines that Maleficent has cursed to be around there are so overgrown that he can't get through, and he cuts and he hacks and he tries to get there, but it takes so many years that she's been there for like 20, 30, 40. We don't even know how much time has gone by. I believe in one of the variations, it's like several generations of men keep hearing about this woman who's like sleeping in this tower, and it takes forever for anyone to even like go and try to get her, I believe is one of, again, the weird ironies of this story is that the variations are so different. In some cases, she's woken up right away. In other cases, it takes years.
And that kind of translates into, you know, there are several different fairy tales that are like that too, not just Sleeping Beauty. Look at how many years it takes Beauty and the Beast, how many years she ends up spending with him, how many years he ends up spending before he finds her. It's the same idea, same plot to the story. They hold the same almost, you know, characters even, except it's reversed from Sleeping Beauty. It's almost like, you know, a story of everything you're asleep until you're not. You know that saying, I'm woke? It's an old Victorian style story of being woken up to your surroundings and the people in it.
Yeah, and that you could be sort of put into this state of almost a coffin-like sleep, but still alive. You know, it's sort of a weird conversation, but not really. When we look at how they viewed death, or how they viewed dying, really, oftentimes bodies would be laid out for days. And just to make sure that the person was actually dead, because there had been stories about them not really being dead.
Live burials. There's a variant to that as well with the bell, wherein they tied a string to the deceased's hand and above ground, where the groundskeeper would stay for days on end, or the one who was the grave keeper would stay there and wait for the bell to ring, just in case, you know, they didn't inter someone, a living being. So it has a lot to do with that too. At those times, that happened quite frequently. That is, a live burial is what led to vampiric stories as well.
Right, and that's just one of the... I just find that this one is kind of a conundrum, because it really has so many variations to it and so many tendrils that you could say that she's connected to many different stories. The one that I feel that she's closely connected to, or very closely connected to, is that Jacob Grimm wrote an almost similar story called The Three Spinning Women. And in this one, there's this girl who wouldn't spin. She hated spinning. And a queen was driving by, and basically yelled out to this woman, "Oh, do you have any daughters here that spin?" And the woman, ashamed to admit that her daughter was lazy, says, "I cannot make her stop spinning. She wants to spin and spin and spin forever. I can't even deal with the amount of spinning my child wants to do." And this girl is taken to the tower with the queen because obviously, I mean, she wants that for her husband and, or sorry, for her son. And the girl is kept in these quarters, and basically these three women appear that promise that she will, or they will do the work for her, that so that she won't have to, as long as she invites them to the wedding and declares them her family. And so she agrees, but looking at these women, she's realizing, how in the world am I going to bring these ugly women to my wedding and say that they're my family? Because her husband-to-be is going to assume that she's going to take on the qualities of these women. One of them had a lip so big that it drooped to the floor. The other one had a foot so big from all the peddling. And the other one had a thumb so big from twisting all the thread. So she actually does go through and invites these women to her wedding and declares them to be her family. And her husband, the husband looks at these women and says, "Well, if that's the way that women are going to turn out, you will never spin again." And so she's then kept from working. And this kind of relates to Sleeping Beauty because there's this idea of the spindle, this and what that really means. So women in medieval history, and probably up until the 18th century, were known for clothing manufacturing, most of the time doing it by hand, in that they would take sheep's wool, turn it into thread, and weave their own garments. And spinning was a big part of a woman's life. In fact, it was their number one export, their number one job. So if you had a woman that could spin for you, that was an incredible value because you had a woman who could make clothes. There are many, many, many variations and deep stories about how there are significant religious and monetary ties to spinning. In fact, in a book called Roles of the Northern Goddess, the author actually goes into how spinning was connected to royal houses. So if anything, in Sleeping Beauty, we're getting this connection that Briar Rose, or in some variants she's called Briar Rose, and other variants she's called Little Rose. Yeah, and she her connection to spinning is because she is of royal blood. So the fact that she pricks herself on a spinning wheel is a connection back to, again, this idea of women, of magic, that obviously women would have gotten pricked when they were spinning. Obviously, there would have been some blood in the thread. And there might be, although this might be a little bit of a stretch here, there might be a connection between that and the idea of threads being magical in themselves. When we go back to mythology and you look at Frigga as a goddess, for example, she is said to spin all the threads of fate. So there might be a concept here where spinning itself, or the act of spinning, is a connection to fate, to destiny, to this sort of this ability for your bride to see the future. And that could be a very strong and powerful thing to have. So I kind of feel that this is really connected to the idea of spinning and of the spinning wheel that is featured in Sleeping Beauty.
Absolutely, it's all about fate. Her fate was supposed to be death, and it turned out to be sleep instead. Her fate was to be rescued. And if you can go a little into another variation of Frigga, you've got the three fates for other people who have a different belief system, or even for mainstream Christianity, your destiny is through God, so to speak, and He spins your destiny for you, that He has everything already written out for you. It's the same tone, right? That same lesson. This is your fate.
And actually, fascinatingly enough, when I was researching fairy tales, when I got to read this book by this mother and daughter duo. I believe the book is titled Mirror Mirror, but I'm going to have to look that up for our audience. It's a very good book. Absolutely fascinating. Follows the history of a lot of fairy tales. But the book is really amusing because it's a mother and daughter. They talk about each of the tales as it goes through. And it's very funny to see an old generation and younger generation's lens of looking at these tales. It's a really fun, light read that is thoroughly enjoyable. And I highly recommend the book. But when I was doing research for fairy tales after reading that, I discovered that in Roles of the Northern Goddess, which is, I have to look up the author because it's not coming up out of my head. She actually mentioned in the book that there is a connection between Mary, Mother of God, and Frigga, because apparently Mary used to be featured wearing a red headdress. Red is the royal color. Red was only used for queens and kings. That's why red dye was so expensive, because it was literally only worn by royals. So red in heathen society has a very deep connection to Frigga. And apparently there's a story, and I'm sort of muddled on the details, so please don't quote me directly here, everybody. But in Roles of the Northern Goddesses, she mentions a story that features this tale of this woman that could turn silk red just by touch. And that this skill was so sought after that people would flock to this woman to get her to weave this very special red silk. That woman happens to have some correlation and connection to the goddess Mary. So I really highly encourage everybody to look at this, because apparently Mary used to be featured holding a distaff, which is the tool used by heathen women to make thread. And it was used in all of Germanic society. Most of Northern Europe used drop spindles. I don't know what or if it was used by people who lived in Middle East, but it's very likely that women used a drop spindle there as well. But drop spindles are connected to the idea of spinning, of magic, because the drop spindle itself is said to be connected to fate. So I just thought I would go on that little bit of a wild tangent there, but highly recommend that everybody check out the Roles of the Northern Goddess, because she explains quite plainly how women were seen as both royal, both connected to blood, connected to thread, and the idea of us making garments themselves were magical. And that's kind of fascinating when you think about it.
And those connections too are, you're right, are fascinating. It's also, again, comes right back to the womb again, the creation of life, the taking care of life, the healing of life, the raising of life. It's always coming back to that female capability of creating life or creativity in its very pure essence.
And you could say that weaving fate or weaving thread is very akin to the creation of DNA. We are weaving a life into existence within the womb. And even if you are going to have your child created with the help of science, that does not negate the fact that DNA is still being woven into that being. And so I believe that the connection to weaving, the connection to things like Sleeping Beauty and Frigga, and the idea of fate and thread is really saying to us that we're connected to a force that is greater than what we can understand as human beings. And whatever that force that you believe exists is, it's there. And whether it's in the permutations of our DNA, or whether it's in the creative force that we put it out into life, or whether you believe that that force is God or some kind of God, it doesn't really matter. The point of all these tales is to tell you that there's an aspect of life that is deeply rooted and connected to the past. And that is in the thread. The very strands of our life are connected.
Well, you and can I also think that's... say, sorry for interrupting you.
No, that's okay.
You can also say that we weave stories. The very story itself that's woven by the writer is weaving and creating a life of its own.
Exactly. And I think that just the concept of that to me is just mind blowing that we are all part of a woven tapestry that is infinitely looped into each other, whether we're doing this by hand, by physical expression, by just our mere existence, is connecting us to a deeper, more non-physical world that we sort of have to remember exists. And I hope that when people read Sleeping Beauty, they see something more in it than just a princess and Maleficent and all that, that they're seeing a reflection of, again, the power of women, that they're the ones weaving the fate. They're the ones creating destiny. They're the ones, really forming and creating and pushing life. And that's a very interesting thing to look at.
Absolutely. You really hit that one on the mark. I agree completely with what you just said.
Yeah, so I think that wraps up our discussion on Sleeping Beauty. And this episode of the Nevermore podcast is going to be featuring our latest release of the book Immortal Chronicles, Night and Day, Book One. To stop the evil one, they must work together to find the key. Can the agents of IA and the Immortal tolerate each other long enough to do that? Find out in the first book of the Immortal Chronicles, Night and Day, by Todd Evans and our executive coordinator, Shiel Milan Berube. The book is available in Kindle format only for the low price of $3. In fact, we're very excited to announce that the Three Little Sisters will be having occasional titles available in Kindle only for $3. The $3 helps us support writers around the globe and supports independent publishing houses like ours. To keep independent publishing houses alive, we need readers like you. Stop by and check out one of our publications. Please leave a review on Amazon and keep liking and sharing all of our posts to make sure that we can continue the work of making every story matter. That's the end of this episode. Our thanks to Mobile Sounds for doing all of our mixing on all of our podcasts. You can check them out on their Facebook page at Mobile Sounds.